The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Alicia Menendez. Alicia is an award-winning multimedia journalist and news anchor for MSNBC. Previously, she was the co-host of PBS's Amina Poor and Company. A contributing editor at The Bustle, she hosts the podcast Latina to Latina. She has also contributed to ABC's Nightline and World News Tonight, as well as Emmy-nominated 2014 election night coverage. She has a new book. It's called The Likeability Trap, How to Break Free and Succeed as You Are. Alicia Menendez, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
As I was reading your excellent new book, I was reminded of an Audre Lorde quote. She said, quote, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation. And that is an act of political warfare." The fight is personal, it's cultural, and it's political, I think. And I think that's overall what this book is saying, right?
Right, absolutely. I mean, there's so much out there about likability. So many books about how to be a more likable version of yourself. This is not that book.
Right.
This is about taking a really critical look at likability, why we like people, the many biases that shape why we like people, why we don't like other people, our personal preferences. And for women in particular, asking why it is that it is so challenging to be a likable lady leader.
Mm-hmm. And we had on an academic who wrote a book about popularity. That is not the same thing as likability, right?
No, and I think you're talking about Mitch Pritstein, I quote in my book, and they are very different things. And part of what I found very challenging about writing a book about likability is that it is a very nebulous concept, right? So popularity is about status. If you've made your way through high school, then you know what popularity is. But likability is different, right? You could be liked by very few people, but they could like you very much. And the factors that shape who we like and who we don't are also really hard to identify. Sometimes even for ourselves, right? There are people who I like or whose company I enjoy, and I couldn't totally tell you why that is. There are people at work who we really get along with and other people who we have more friction with. And sometimes it's hard to step back and assess why we find some people likable and why we don't find other people likable.
And what the social science tells us, though, is that you get ahead at work not because you do good work, but because you are well-liked.
Well, I mean, I think you do.
It can
have
be both.
To do good work. It can be both.
Mm-hmm.
But there is certainly a premium placed on likability, and it does impact who people want to have on their teams, who they're willing to give big assignments to, who they're willing to give raises to, and where it becomes additionally complicated for women is that the things you need to do to be what society considers a likable woman are very often the exact opposite of what we consider to be an effective and good leader. And so if you're a woman who is very strong, assertive, able to advocate for herself and for others, those can be very important skills. And at the same time, we live in a culture where that can make a woman less likable in the office, in interpersonal relationships, in the public sphere. And then you have women who are all of the quote-unquote things that women are supposed to be, kind, communal, nurturing. And then because they're those things, they're not seen as leaders. So women end up in this impossible situation where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Yeah, and there's so many dualities that you talk about. Of course, the double bind, and also this idea around warmth and strength, right? That appear to be in conflict with each other, which it's not true, but it is true. It's a reality.
Right. I mean, the ideal for almost anyone is to hit this perfect balance of strength and warmth, right? So strength to have people believe that you have the ability to follow through on your plans, warmth so that people like you, they trust you. And yet getting to that sweet spot is really challenging for most leaders. And what becomes particularly challenging for women is that what tends to happen is as one of those factors goes up, the other goes down. Mm-hmm. So if you are in an environment where strength is really what is valued, and strength tends to be what's valued at work. If you're a woman and you perform strength, all of a sudden your warmth starts going down. And so even as you're gaining the benefit of being perceived as strong, you're often being penalized for the fact that you're not as warm as your coworkers, colleagues might want a woman to be.
You talk about that in success, and I want to quote you in the book. You say, quote, "The success penalty isn't merely a professional impediment. It's a mind fuck. It threatens not just our upward mobility, but our very sense of self." I mean, this is like damaging stuff that happens.
I know.
It's terrible.
Yes, if you could just needlepoint that on a pillow for me, I'd appreciate it. But that was a big part of what I really wanted to get at with this book, which is that very often when we talk about the success penalty, it is framed as though as women become more successful, they become less likable. And first of all, that makes it seem like that's a one-time choice. Are you a woman who cares more about success or more about likability? It's not.
Right.
It's baked into every decision that a woman makes along her professional trajectory. So when you are applying for a job, how much you stress your competence over your social ability, when you go into advocate for a raise, when you ask for a new title, when you ask to be put on the best team, all of those little decisions come with their own success penalty. And what I found talking to women, and what I think has been underappreciated in this larger discussion about women at work, is that women are tired. I mean, yeah. All of this hyper-focus on how women do their work, this sense of, you know, women across cultures are raised to care very much about others' feelings and how others think of them. Now, there's a value to that, right? Mm-hmm. It is great for people in relationships, whatever variety, to be aware of each other's feelings, but it also can become perverted where it becomes either the only thing that someone cares about or it is sort of put on them that it should be the most important thing that they care about. And so for women, like I said in the book, like myself, who I value success, I'm deeply ambitious, I want to be successful, but I also do care about other people and I do care about how other people think of me. And so when you run up against the reality of I may have to choose between these two things, that's not just a cerebral choice. That cuts to the core of your being, because I would like to live in a world where I can have both.
Yeah. You know, this is so much about, I remember when we interviewed Anand Giridharadas about Winners Take All, you know, where he really goes after a bunch of my friends, a bunch of thought leaders who would speak at places like Aspen, who would talk about the need to be others focused and to be deep listeners, which is all fine and good if you aren't under threat. And recognizing that there's these societal structures and inequalities that are also at work, you know, should force us. It's not, again, that listening is bad or being others focused, it's good. But you can't just say that without trying to attack this system that's in place.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things about the system that I think has likewise been underexplored is this question of authenticity.
Oh, great. I'm glad you're talking about that.
We're often told that, you know, in order to be an effective leader, you have to be authentic. In order to be a likable leader, you have to be authentic. Well, if women and a lot of people of color are performing a version of leadership that was not defined by them or for them, simply just to survive in some workplaces, if they're lucky to thrive, well, then you're likely not able to be completely authentic to yourself. And so when you're talking about these systems and these structures, a lot of it is about how we define leadership, who we see when we imagine a leader, and if they're the only ones who get to be likable and they're the only ones who get to be authentic, well, then the system's really just not built for the rest of us.
You say it beautifully in the book. You say, quote, "You can be told to bring your whole self to work only to realize what you probably already knew, that your workplace hasn't done the work necessary to receive you. And so instead, you must continue in ways big and small to cover." And again, another pain point, the more you have to cover who you are and what you are and what you believe, that's, you know, death by a thousand paper cuts.
Yes, perfectly put. I mean, one of the things that I heard from the dozens of women I interviewed was that it seemed the louder their workplace insisted that you bring your whole self to work, the less prepared that workplace often was to really do the work of valuing diversity, of making sure that everyone felt listened to, included, valued. And I think that there's a lot of work to do at the organizational level. One of the big things I heard was that if there's not buy-in at the very top, if leadership doesn't believe in the value of diversity and doesn't really want to implement that on their teams, then it is hard to make progress at the employee level. There has to be that buy-in at the top, or you can't create an office culture where people truly feel that they can show up as themselves, right? I mean, you can be told, bring your whole self to work, and then have these, what can feel like minor run-ins, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and sometimes these things don't quite feel egregious enough to bring to HR, but, you know, you show up and, you know, you've changed your hairstyle and everybody wants to talk about it. Or in a worst case scenario, someone wants to touch your locks, and that is simply not acceptable. But that means that there's something off about the workplace that is not inherently understood.
I should mention, too, that the book is kind of told in three parts. It's part memoir, part interviews with many women leaders, and part evidence. You quote and you find research to back up the stuff you're talking about. And I was pretty blown away when, and we can start with this, because you told a black woman, a friend of yours, that you cared about being well-liked. Mm-hmm. And she said something back to you, right? What'd she say?
She said, "That's so white of you."
And
she laughed, she sighed and laughed after she said it, but she really got me thinking about why that is.
Mm-hmm. And because this is, I'll quote the book, "Scholars argue that a black woman, for example, is worse off than a black man or a white woman because she faces racial bias and gender bias."
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, one of the things that I, in talking with women and in researching for the book, came to realize was I understood that there are additional barriers for women and additional barriers for women of color, but the challenges that black women are up against at work are very unique. The one I sort of least prepared for or least aware of was the extent to which a black woman who, you've seen all of the research I've seen, can be very ambitious and less ambivalent about their ambition, happy to say, I want a promotion, I want to play at the top of my game. But in an office where they are the only or one of few, much more likely to become invisible in that office.
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge is how, for those women, how they present themselves as leader, present themselves as people who are worthy of opportunity, and make sure simply that they're on people's radar. And one of the issues that this intersects with is this question of sponsorship, which has become something of a buzzy word, different than a mentor. A mentor sort of guides you. A sponsor really delivers. This is an idea from Sylvia Ann Hewlett, who has a great book about finding a sponsor that I highly recommend. Well, black women want sponsorship. Black women with the ambition that they have deserve sponsorship, and very often they're among the least likely members of the workforce to actually be able to find sponsors. And so there are these organizational disconnects between what workers are willing to bring and then how organizations are able to truly support them at a structural level.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because I work with a lot of very strong and vocal Black women and who work alongside a lot of very strong, less vocal white women. And so this idea that, yeah, they could essentially give a fuck because of they're so, you know, recognizing where they are in the sort of social order. That was really interesting, sort of being like, oh, I get this, because there's certain white feminists who I work with who actually won't speak up and feel very much sort of trapped in the middle.
Yeah. And then I think, though, there's a flip to what you're saying, mm-hmm. which is that very often a Black woman or a minority woman who is in a room and is the only person who is in that room, it falls on her unfairly to identify problems in the work, in the culture, and she runs into this challenge of the fact that by identifying the problem and addressing the problem, she often unfairly becomes the problem. And so even as you sort of describe these women you work with as strong, as vocal, that same idea can play against them in a different office environment.
Yeah, no, completely. And because they're when they are normally speaking up, it's because they are in a room with other Black women as part of an ensemble, right? And so they there's a bit more safety, and they're satirists, they're comedians, you know, one of the things I talk about in the podcast, you know, I hired people at Second City for many years. I hired people to disrespect who I was, because it's very much about you know, getting at the man. You talk in the book about feedback. And you say, quote, when women do get feedback, it tends to over-index on their communication style, which seems to be, you know, there's a hidden message there, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've experienced this and I've experienced it in both directions. I've experienced it as a person who receives feedback, and I've experienced it as the person who gives feedback. And I've had to think critically about some of the times when I've done that in ways that may not have fully served me or served the people that I work for. So it can be anything from the way you sit in your chair to the way you use your voice to the way you use your hands. I had one woman tell me that she had a communications coach who told her that she used her hands entirely too much, and that if she insisted on using her hands, then she had to learn to use them in a, quote, more masculine way. So to say that she should count down her points aggressively on one hand, and then it would be okay. And that can be okay. It can make you a more effective communicator. It can help other people see you as a leader. I remember a piece of feedback I got around my communication that was very helpful to me, which was about learning how to reframe complaints as positive requests.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Some of that stuff can be good. The problem is that becomes so much of the feedback women get that it ends up happening in the absence of other feedback, right? So instead of talking about how you run regressions or how you could work on, you know, the memo you put together or client relations, you're constantly talking about your voice. And so it ends up taking up a lot of space without necessarily moving people forward. And part of that may have to do with the fact that we know there's this reality of the fact that there's a way we see leaders and then a way we see women, but it ends up just becoming a lot of noise. And women, at least the women I spoke with, go to great extents to sort of, you know, meet all of that feedback, to honor that feedback, to implement that feedback. And then the feedback just shifts and it becomes about something different. I mean, because this feedback can be highly context-specific and highly subjective. So I'm not sure how beneficial it is. And I do think it, though, of all the things that I talk about, becomes one of the easier things to address and correct. So, for example, I spoke with this great executive coach, Katarina Kostula, who had just a fabulous line that she uses when you are a person who receives stylistic feedback. So to say that if you and I were together and we were in a feedback session and you said to me, well, Alicia, you know, you're just too aggressive, that one of the things that I can do is say, okay, compared to whom? And that just that simple question can often help for the person who's giving the feedback to really, in that moment, assess whether that is a completely subjective analysis or whether there really is a threshold of aggression that the person is crossing over into that no longer serves them. And then the other question she asks or has people ask is, you know, if you told me I'm too aggressive, can you please offer me examples or evidence of a time when my being, quote, too aggressive changed the results or the product that I am supposed to bring to the team? Draw the line for me between my style and input. And there may be times where there is a bright line between those two things, and it is helpful to understand, okay, the way that I am behaving is actually having repercussions for my team, but sometimes there's no connect. You're doing everything you're supposed to be doing. You're delivering results. And the way you are is just the way you are. And the idea would be to just give women a little bit more space to lead however they see fit.
The compared to who thing reminded me, I think it's in Michael Lewis's book. I don't know if you know the story about Daryl Morey, who is the GM for the Houston Rockets. And he got very involved in behavioral science and learned about unconscious bias. And he started making his scouts, when they would come in and, you know, talk about these new players and they wanted to compare them to other players, he said, you can only compare a black player to a white player and vice versa. Because you keep bringing me, you're like, this is Hakeem Olajuwon type, and you're only doing that because he looks like him, not that he plays like him.
Wow.
Yeah. Because we do this, right? We do this, and we fall into these, we as, you know, here, let's make it easier on, you know, all the white men who are, you know, shaking in their boots. Human beings do this. We make these patterns, and we have to upset them if we want to see things anew. And the other thing you talk about in this section, too, is the dangers around social feedback, social media, which is, you know, just... I see my friends, especially my good friend Sarah Spain, who is a sports person at ESPN, and she just gets harassed on social constantly, and she never backs down. I mean, she is a powerhouse, but I do not know how she keeps up the energy.
Right. I mean, to be a public woman in the public sphere is to contend with that on an almost daily basis. I would even take a step back from that, though, yeah, and say, before you even get to the worst of the worst, which is, you know, a constant barrage of harassment, there's just this pressure now to be a public person. Mm. And I think that extends to many more people than it did prior to the age of social media, right? You used to just be able to be, you know, a person who hit your numbers, who delivered for your team, and now there's this sense that everyone's supposed to be a thought leader, and everyone's supposed to be weighing in on Twitter, and everyone is supposed to be showing you pictures of their vacation on Instagram. And I think that's very challenging for people to whom it's not authentic to be that type of sharer. And I think it adds a dimension to this likability conversation, which is, one, now your likability feels really quantifiable. Mm-hmm. You feel like, oh, I have a lot of followers, or I don't have a lot of followers. This post got a lot of likes, or it didn't get a lot of likes. And it's very often behavior that we ascribe to teenagers. But let's be real. We all still feel, most of us still feel that pressure. And so when we talk about likability in particular, it's as though the world has expanded, and we're not just comparing ourselves to the person who sits in the cubicle next to us, but we're comparing ourselves very often to what, sort of just in our own mind, our peers, right? Peers we follow on social media, and then it becomes this larger game of, this person got invited to this thing, this person did this thing, they were employee of the month. And it's like, they're employee of the month at a company you don't work for. Like, why right, would you like, compare yourself?
You're not in the running for that award.
No, like, but in, you know, the middle of the night when you're scrolling through your phone because you can't sleep, it's not always easy to have that perspective. And to your point about women online, you know, there really is this endless feedback loop. We know that a lot of the feedback that women get tends to be violent in nature, very often, you know, sexually violent in nature, and that there's a reason for it, which is the objective is to shut that woman down, to not have her be a part of the public discourse. And so bravo to all of those women who continue to show up and continue to share their opinions, even in light of that harassment. But there is a really complicated and dark side to the fact that we now, so many of us, live our lives in this public way and live it in a way where it feels mandatory, right? Where we're not really asking ourselves, do I want to do this? Is this serving me? Is this authentic to who I am?
Yeah, the ought to versus, you know, or do I really want to? I'm curious, in terms of the way you've walked through life and choosing to write a book like this, and with your eyes open the way they've been open, I had to give a talk once. And I forget the format was like 20 slides and then you talk along with it. I think it's a Japanese form. And I was talking about growing up in proximity to celebrity because my dad was not nationally famous, but he was locally famous. He was on WGN radio for 33 years. He hosted a TV show here. And so like people knew who he was. And I got to sort of view, you know, my semi-famous dad, from a bit of a distance. And it really gave me, I think, a lot of insight. And part of his job was interviewing famous people. So I would meet all kinds of cool, you know, famous people. So I was always in proximity. And you grew up also with a famous dad, political, different. But I'm wondering if that gave you a little bit of distance that allowed you to kind of build the perspective that you've had that would bring you to writing a book like this.
I don't know that it gave me distance so much as that it made likability feel like something that was really tied to one's ability to do one's work. So when I was growing up, my dad was the mayor of the town I lived in, Union City, New Jersey. By the time I was about 8 or 9, he was elected to Congress. He's now a senior U.S. senator from New Jersey. So he has always been in elected office my entire life. And I will say, to your point about being locally famous, I actually think there's perhaps no greater fame than being locally famous.
Yeah, good point.
Because, you
the
know,
mayor.
Your world is a little bit smaller, and everyone in your world knows you and knows the person who you perceive to be famous, and the sort of the more you get out of that world,
right,
even if that person's status increases, you know, so too does the world, or the scope. So my dad was never more famous than when he was the mayor of Union City, and Union City was the only world that we knew.
Sure.
And when you are an elected official, how people feel about you determines your job security.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes this very important element of who you are, and how you are perceived out in the world. I think the sort of masochistic element of my own life is that I too chose to become a public person, you know, by virtue of pursuing journalism, by writing a book like this that puts me in the public sphere. Because when you are putting yourself out there for public consumption, it's not just do the people I go home to every night like me? Do the people in my office like me? There's a broader universe of people who are forming opinions on you that may be based on never knowing you, right? There's someone listening to this podcast right now who's deciding if they like you and if they like me.
Right.
And we may never meet them. And perhaps if we sat next to each other at dinner, we'd love each other.
Mm-hmm.
But in this format, I'm just not their cup of tea. And that is part of what, especially as I watch, you know, the 2020 election, and I think about these candidates, it's part of what makes it so complicated, which is we ask this question about who would you rather have a beer with, that's predicated on the fact that you'll probably never have a beer with this person. So you're being asked to evaluate and judge people from a distance and through screens, and that can't be an entirely accurate assessment of who someone is. Ever.
I am going to suggest that if someone is still listening at 29 minutes in, that they're cool with you. It's just so you feel okay about that.
Yeah. But don't you know, I'm a likability fiend, so it's not enough that they're cool with me.
I guess a fair point.
Which, as you know, is where I started this project. I mean, I really went into this wanting to be a person who cares and to learn to care less, because it doesn't feel cool to care. Like, that's not a bragging point that people go around talking about, like, well, you know, people liking me really matters to me. No, it's like, it would be great to move through the world exactly as you are, with, you know, with regard for others, but without making it sort of the most important element of how you make decisions and how you live your life. And what I found was whether you're like me and you care a lot, or whether you're a person who doesn't care at all, you end up paying a price, whether that's an internal price for caring so much, or it's an external price because you don't care and you live in a world, in a culture, and most often in a workplace where it's mandatory that you care.
You have a really a lovely sentence, which I think kind of sums up what I would call the solution, which is, quote, "To fully empower women to lead, we have to stop asking women to reimagine themselves and instead encourage everyone to reimagine leadership." That's it. I mean, that's
thank you. Thank you. That's the book. That's the idea, which is, it. So long as you, there's this great exercise that I write about in the book, which is, Tina Kupfer I believe she's a behavioral scientist, and she talks about how if you ask a group, just close your eyes and imagine a leader, or doodle a leader on a piece of paper. When she asks people to show her the drawing, it's almost always male leaders that are drawn on the paper. Even when people are like, well, I didn't mean for it to be male. It's like, well, you used male pronouns to describe this leader. That's because that's what we still think of when we think of leaders. And so we have to shift that to include more people, and certainly more women. And until we do that, you can't really get out from under this likability question. And I think you see that very often when we talk about women who are running for office, that there's like always, it always sounds like there's something off about women candidates, right? The way we talk about them. We're like, she's great, except, or I like her, but I don't think she's electable, or like, but my, it's like, there's always something. And it's like, not that woman, not that woman, not that woman. Well, maybe the problem is not these individual women, and more that when we imagine leadership, we imagine men.
I feel like, yes, of course. I feel like Liz Warren, for some, and I can't name it, feels like she's changing that a bit. And maybe this is, I'm in a bubble and I'm not seeing it all, but it does feel like that was such a big hair shirt that she was wearing at the beginning, that more and more, and maybe it's just that she's got a really skilled, good campaign that she's running, but feels like she might, you know, take that leap.
She is certainly facing the likability question less than she was at the beginning, and she is certainly facing it by a fraction that Hillary Clinton faced it both times that she ran for president. But I think that there's the possibility that we've sort of understood likability to be a problematic way of assessing candidates, and shifted instead to two other elements that I think we hear a lot more about this cycle. One is electability.
Right.
And we hear that question come up about someone like Senator Warren a lot, which is, you know, someone may say even, I like her, I don't know if she is electable. Mm-hmm. And that question becomes the proxy for talking about likability and talking about leadership, which is to say, you know, maybe I would vote for her, but I'm not certain that other people would, as though we're then shifting the burden to other people. The other thing I think we hear a lot about instead of likability is authenticity, and how some candidates are authentic and some candidates are not authentic. And, you know, some of that has to do with gut feeling. I get that. But I also think there's an additional element, which is that if you have traverse these elite spaces as someone who is not in the majority of those spaces, then yeah, the likelihood is that you have done some element of performance in order to get to this spot. So there's a real irony as you're about to transcend, to make that leap to the highest level of power, that the very thing you have done to get to this point is all of a sudden the thing that people say might limit you from making it to the very, very top.
Yeah.
And so while we don't hear about likability as much, I do think that there are second cousins to it that end up taking its place.
Yeah, you're probably. I'm an optimist. I'm trying to find.
We could use optimists. That's good.
Yeah. Okay, so we always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. So, in the parlance of improvisation, you get nowhere saying no when you're making something out of nothing in a group of people, and you can't actually just stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Yes, and I am a failed theater kid, so I am offended that you have described. I'm like, of course I know what yes and is. Yes, in fact, this book was a yes and situation in that when I, was originally shopping it around, I did imagine it to be much more memoir-driven. And when I met my editor at HarperCollins Business, Stephanie Hitchcock, she said to me, what do you think about shifting this to include other women and to look more at how this functions in the workplace? And it was one of those moments where it would have been really easy to say, like, no, that's not the book that I'm interested in writing. But it was easy to say yes, and because what she was offering me was a much bigger, broader context for having a conversation that could have felt like it was just about me or just about other people who, like me, care a lot about being well-liked. And I think it's much more interesting to think about it as, like, whether you care or you don't care isn't really the problem. The problem is that we are in a scenario where no matter what you do, care, don't care, no matter how you act, it's really hard for women to hit that sweet spot and to be able to lead in a way that is authentic to them.
And I think she gave you a harder book to write, and therefore, right? I mean, that's a harder book to write than just talking about yourself. You've got great stories. You've lived an interesting life. But in that, you really, and that's, you know, again, the source of creativity is when we get in those uncomfortable spaces with constraints, with some understanding what we need to do, and we have to make those discoveries. And that's when you make leaps. And I really do. I think this is an important book, especially for men to read, but women as well, because I think they're going to find some you give shape and words to some things that I know they think but maybe don't know how to talk about. It's excellent. The book is called The Likeability Trap, Alicia Menendez. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for reading the book. It means so much to me.
Of course. Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive. survive.